Hey everyone, this amazing ESO Network show is brought to you by our fine sponsor, Amazon.com. Please remember to shop Amazon for all your geeky needs, no matter what time of the year it is. All you need to do is go to ESOpodcast.com/ESOAmazon or click on the Amazon banner on the ESO Network webpage to go to our e-store. It's the best way to shop and the best way to support this program, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. Okay, that's enough of me babbling for now. Now on with your regular scheduled show.
White Rocket Entertainment.
These are the Cubans, baby. These are the Cohibas, the Monte Cristos. This is a kinetic kill sidewinder vehicle with a secondary cyclotrimethylene trinitramine RDX burst. It's capable of busting the bunker under the bunker you just busted. If it were any smarter, it'd write a book. A book that would make Ulysses look like it was written in crayon. And it would read it to you. This is my Eiffel Tower. This is my Rachmaninoff's Third, my Pieta. It's completely elegant, it's bafflingly beautiful, and it's capable of reducing the population of any standing structure to zero. I call it the ex-wife.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 246.
It's the Avengers Assemble podcast from the Jarvis Heads of AvengersAssemble.net. Now, here's your host, Van Allen Plexico.
Hello, and welcome to the Avengers Assemble podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment and the Jarvis Heads of AvengersAssemble.net in association with your Station One network. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and I'm joined this episode by Mark Buskett. In addition to being a fantastic author, Mark is one of the nearly original Jarvis Heads of AvengersAssemble.net and a respected movie reviewer, particularly of movies like the one we're going to discuss today. And you are our go-to guy for talking about the Marvel movies, Mark, so I'm glad to have you back for our second installment.
Glad to be here.
So we broke down Iron Man from 2008 last time, a couple of episodes ago, and we're going to continue to sprinkle these throughout the Avengers Assemble feed as we go forward. So we're up to the second. I'm trying to think where does the Incredible Hulk fit in the timeline now? Because it just dawned on me that there was that movie too.
Well, I guess technically the Incredible Hulk movie is the second film, and okay. Iron Man 2 is the third film.
We'll have to do that one next, then, I guess. I didn't think about that for some reason. Okay, but we've watched Iron Man 2 again, and I, for one, have very different feelings about this movie than I did when I saw it in the theater. I was very surprised. I started watching it yesterday afternoon, and I finished it this morning. I had not watched the DVD, I don't think, all the way through since I got it. And so I had some very different reactions this time around, maybe just knowing what I know and knowing, you know, what was stronger about it and what was weaker about it. What did you, because you just watched it again too, right?
Yeah.
Did you have the exact same reaction you saw when you saw it in the theater, or did you see it differently this time? I'm curious.
No, I saw it much differently this time, and I think that comes down to just the sheer number of films we have now.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the time it was still like any superhero movie felt like a crumb that the studios were tossing out to us. So you ran to it as soon as you could. Maybe you saw it twice, you know, in that faint hope that your, you know, $8 would get them to make another one. But yeah, I had a very, I won't say very like radically different, but I did have a slightly less, less impression of the film this time than I had originally.
I was going to ask you, because we haven't said if it was better or worse this time, because here's the weird thing about it that totally caught me by surprise. I liked it a lot more this time. How funny is that? All right.
That is funny.
So this should make for a very, very entertaining conversation for everybody to listen to now, because we kind of saw it in such different ways. Now, let's go back to 2010 when this movie came out. We'd had Iron Man 1 and The Incredible Hulk. So we'd established that Robert Downey character as Tony Stark. That was the revelation, I think, that came out of Iron Man 1 was Downey as Stark. Oh my goodness, how entertaining, all the entertainment, right? And so that was what they wanted to milk going forward. They tried to recreate that formula by bringing back Jon Favreau and bringing back Gwyneth Paltrow and bringing back Robert Downey and having him just be Tony Stark. Woo, baby. But the thing is, I'm of two minds about this movie, because on the one hand, we get a lot of really cool stuff in it, and we get less of the stuff I don't like in it from the first movie. But on the other hand, this movie is something of a mess, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, I think it's a complete mess. I think it's I think the first third is good, and I think the last third is satisfactory, if not great. But to me, it's the middle of this movie is just really, really brutal. Like, I mean, I think it like sometimes sequels want to justify the box office of the first one by making them more serious than they have to. Like, I think in this film, it's because, I mean, we all know, or I won't say all, but most of us know, you know, in the comics, Tony Stark struggled with alcoholism, and they want to introduce that here. And I feel like it didn't mesh with the version of the character that Stark had created. I also think this film is just feels wrong when you get to that middle section. It feels like the opening bit is it, and it starts with that darker tone, right? So I don't know if the film was like, well, it's a sequel, so it has to be darker than the original. But it starts with the bad guy, you know. There's less joy in the film, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there is the Stark parts at the beginning are great, but I think then he goes through his crisis and because of it, you know, he's dying and all that, and sort of recovers at the end. But I think it's a complete mess. That, which is not to say I don't enjoy it, because I do enjoy it, but it has fallen down the list. You know, almost every movie that comes out now ends up getting ranked. You know, every Marvel movie that comes out now gets ranked ahead of this, and this one keeps going further and further down the list.
It has so many pieces that are good. I mean, there's very few movies I can think of that, you know how they say the sum is greater than the sum of its parts or whatever. It's like the various pieces of this movie, some of them are great. I mean, some of the pieces in this movie, I think, are among the best things Marvel's done. But when they put them all together, it's like bolting a Mercedes engine onto a Volkswagen body with a Honda tailpipe sticking out the side. And the thing that is created after all that welding and bolting together of these parts is just very clunky.
Yeah.
It's very unwieldy.
It is clunky, and it's like the thing, it never really comes together for me. Like, it never feels like, it never feels like a real story to me. Like, it feels like the parts of the film that should be emphasized, like, away from Stark, are de-emphasized. You know, it feels like Stark is kind of childish at times, and in moments where he shouldn't be childish. Like, I just feel his whole crisis is just, I mean, it's just, to me, it doesn't work, and it's not fun to watch, and it's not needed in a film like this. You can still get real kind of character development in without making a guy fall all the way back down to the bottom. Like, why did we need to see him, you know, stumble around drunk at a party shooting watermelons with his ion cannon, you know, to have him be like the visionary scientist again? So yeah, it is. Some of it is really. You're right, though. I think I totally agree. Some of it is incredibly well made, but it feels to me like it definitely suffers from sequelitis. That it knows it needs to have certain beats that resonated in the first film, but it doesn't know how to put them into a brand new story, and so it becomes, you know, lesser than its parts, like you said.
Yeah, it's the seams show, the screws and bolts on it show. It just feels like a screenplay that was put together by about five different people, each trying to glue their own thing into it, because it never seems like one seamless story. It tries to go in different directions, and I'm not sure that it ever fully succeeds. Now, I'll go through and name some of the things that I love about it, and you can, you know, chime in too with your list or your reactions. But some of the things I really did, now it is, I spell it M-O-A-R. You do have more Tony in this movie, because they're like, oh, we got to have more. But you're right. They start him out being the cocky, quippy, you know, Tony Stark of the movies. But then he immediately turns into this glowering, glum, oh, I'm going to die, it's all bad guy, which does seem very two, you know. It has number two stamped all over that. Number one, hero ascends. Number two, hero falters and has his Achilles heel exposed. And so that seemed very contrived. In fact, the whole movie is like, it seems so contrived, like it was glued together. But some of the things I love, I think that I like Don Cheadle. I like War Machine in it. It was neat to see another type of Iron Man, like in the comics. I think that Gwyneth Paltrow is solid again. I think that, when I first saw it, I was totally dismissive of Black Widow. But having seen her in the subsequent movies and then going back and watching this one again, I really appreciated what Scarlett Johansson brought to that part so much better this time. I absolutely loved her performance as Black Widow, because in a lot of cases, this is going to sound bizarre for a girl that goes around in a black cat suit with big floofy hair, but in a number of scenes in this movie, her performance is very understated. She does a lot with her eyes and with just tiny little expressions on her face that I just kind of wrote off or just didn't pay any attention to the first time or so that I saw it. But again, having seen her and what she does with the character in the Avengers and stuff like that, going back and watching her here, there's more to it than just her slinking around, sticking out her rear end and stuff. I really liked. I thought she had very good chemistry with Downey, too, and with Paltrow. Okay. And then I got to say, my favorite, I liked the Grand Prix at Monaco scene. That was neat to get to see that, becoming a Grand Prix fan, a Formula One fan the last year. That I had no appreciation at all for that the first time I saw it. But this time I'm like, oh, wow, it's Monaco, you know, so it's totally different. But I'll end with this, and then let me hear yours. My absolute favorite thing about this movie, which I did appreciate the first time, but not nearly as much, I will say this, Sam Rockwell steals this movie. And I'll go even further, Sam, his version of Justin Hammer, which was like this is what I see. When I see Sam Rockwell as Justin Hammer in this movie, I see Gary Oldman. This is like the Gary Oldman part if this was an 80s or 90s movie, okay? And I could totally see him playing it. And I will go even further. I think this Justin Hammer is better than the comics Justin Hammer, who was basically Peter Cushing. And then here's my final point on that. I will say that Sam Rockwell as Justin Hammer in this movie is one of the best Marvel Cinematic Universe villains we have seen on screen yet, if not the best. Now, what do you say to that?
Okay, so let's start with Sam Rockwell. I almost agree with you. I almost agree with you. And here's the problem. His performance, and so this gets back to the idea of the individual parts never quite add up.
Mm-hmm.
He's fantastic. He is absolutely fantastic. He is the most fun character in the film to watch for me. Like, I love, I love the way he uses humor. I love the way, like, I mean, he's clearly like little man syndrome, but when he gets the chance to throw his weight around, that's funny. The scene where he's showing Rhodey all his guns, right? All the different things. I love that scene. I love when he, you know, we got your bird. This is not my bird, but we got your bird and it's a nice bird. Learn to let go of things, right? Like,
yeah.
I love the way he's always, he's like caught between cockiness and like, like petulance almost,
yeah.
Right? Like he goes back and forth from like
jealousy and
like, I'm the guy to, oh, why aren't things working the way I
right.
want them to?
Well, Mark, this is the thing. He's incompetent. This is the thing.
Yeah.
He is the incompetent shadow of Tony Stark. And that's why I like him so much better than the guy in Iron Man 3 is because he's got a lot of the same things Tony has going for him, and he wants to be Tony so bad. And we will watch and appreciate a villain that is competent. Right. If like Darth Vader is a villain, but he's competent. And so you appreciate him and you admire the bad stuff he's doing because he's doing it in a good, in a competent way. Incompetent villains are funny. You know, they don't get as much appreciated because there's nothing to admire there. Not even when they're being bad, they're not doing it well. And so you can't even admire the wellness of their evil. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. But that's where, like, ultimately, like, I can't put him – I mean, you know, the villains in most of the Marvel movies have been plot devices more than they have been kind of
yes.
you know, great threats, right?
Right.
And so it is interesting that, like, his greatest threat is, like, his own incompetence, right?
Yeah.
That he's there to be taken advantage of
yeah.
by the Mickey Rourke character, right? And so I do like that. I do think that they go a little bit too far with it, right? Like I want him to be a little bit more dangerous, right? I want him to be a little bit more competent or like a little bit more like he needs to like what does he do well, right?
Yeah, he has
him. They treat him too much as like a punchline and it should be the difference, right, that I like, the parts of the character that work, right, are when he's almost Tony, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, he can create things, they just don't work as well as Tony's does, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, he is when Stark Industries decides to, you know, change directions, Hammer Industries is there to, like, pick up the slack. But it's not – they can't replace Stark because they're not doing things as well. But they're what, you know, you kind of settle for, you know,
mm-hmm.
I guess that's, you know, that's the version of Tony Stark that Justin Hammer is, right? He's the version of Tony Stark that you settle for when you can't get the real thing.
That's right.
And there's a lot to like in that performance, but I wanted him to like do one thing like well, right? Or, and I mean, or maybe just if they could have sold how his incompetence almost cost everybody, right? Because he's there to get taken advantage of. And so that when he has that scene, like his great moment of triumph, right, is wheeling out all these robots. And I love that all the drones essentially are the same drone with different paint jobs, right? I mean, that's even like an Iron Man thing, right? Like
mm-hmm.
every suit of armor has to look different from the previous one, but they're all essentially
the same.
But with Stark, at least there's a reason why they're different, right? There's a you know, a Hulkbuster armor is bigger because you know it's going to fight the Hulk. So there's more reasons why they look different. Whereas with those drones, it's like they look different. They just a different paint job because that you know it's a cell job. So he is great. I was never like, and maybe part of the problem is, I don't like the Mickey Rourke character. Just there are parts of that movie where I love that character, and there are parts of that movie where he makes me want to punch the TV screen. So.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, I know. I mean, that's the thing is that you have two villains, and one is kind of just an incompetent goof, and the other one, I mean. This is the thing I was noticing watching it again is that they spend so much time setting up Mickey Rourke's character. And then, I mean, I don't know that we ever get enough payoff for all that they, because there's a lot of mystery about him, which a lot of the mystery really is just quirkiness, I think. But you, Well, here's the other thing, too, while we're talking about that, while we're talking about those two guys, you know, we always say that in these superhero movies, like always fights like. So when Iron Man 1, a guy in armor fought a guy in armor. You know, just like in Thor, the god fights the god, you know, whatever. Spider-Man, a guy that swings around the city fights, you know, guys that swing around the city or fly around the city or whatever. Well, in this movie, you split it in half. You've got Tony Stark fighting lesser Tony Stark in Hammer, and you've got Iron Man fighting lesser Iron Man in Vanko / Whiplash or whatever he is.
Yep.
So they've kind of divided the Iron Man and Tony Stark in half and made a villain out of each half.
Yeah, and they have given Stark War Machine as mm-hmm. a sidekick, right? So,
yeah.
like, there's more of him
mm-hmm.
and there's less of his opponents. And so I think, I mean, it just, like, I never feel like Vanko is an actual threat, you
yeah.
know? Like, the Monaco scene is great. I mean, I watching him slice those cars, like, you know, bits of those cars off, like,
mm-hmm.
that's interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know why the rest of the race is still going on, like, but, you know, whatever. Like, seems like people would get on the mic pretty quick and say, stop, you know? There's a guy with electric whips, you know, around, you know, turn 12, you know, like, could you please, like, maybe just pull the car over? But
well, Rosberg and Hamilton were too wrapped up in their duel to pay any attention to that, see?
Yeah, exactly. And so, but you're right. It's like two lesser iron, like he faces two lesser versions of himself. And I think that's really problematic, especially, right? The whole idea of Tony Stark is that he's so wrapped up in being Tony Stark that everybody else has to kind of deal with the collateral damage of that. And
mm-hmm.
the film, to me, never really gets – we don't see enough of Pepper. We don't see enough of Happy. We don't see enough of Rhodey. You know, even we don't see enough of Black Widow kind of dealing with just what it's like to deal with Tony, right? And I think – I hate using the, you know, I would have done it differently mode of mm-hmm. criticism. But I will say the parts that I liked – when Tony's going through his downturn are not the parts with Tony. They're the parts with the other characters kind of reacting to that and
yeah.
dealing with that and compensating for that. So I wish we had gotten more of that. I wish, like, I still don't know why we're supposed to think Vanko is a threat, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, what does he do, right? He stands there without a shirt on, and he has two whips, right,
mm-hmm.
against a guy who's a flying tank. You know what I mean? Like, it just – the threat never seems to work, which is I think is why they give you all of those drones. But the problem mm-hmm. is when you have a hero fighting a swarm, as in – like, it becomes so, you know, depersonalized.
Right.
It becomes so just kind of perfunctory that there's – the final action sequences just fall apart. And then, like, Vanko shows up and they beat him in like 30 seconds. And it's like, oh,
yeah.
Well, I guess that's that, you know,
using a trick that they previewed earlier in the movie. I always like how when they come up with something clever to use at the end, they do this in the Marvel movies every time, it's become very formulaic. They'll have some fancy thing that they use at the end, and so they have to preview it earlier in the movie so you know it's there so that when they use it again, it didn't come out of nowhere. There's, for example, the icing of the armor in Iron Man 1. Like, how'd you deal with the icing problem? What icing problem? Ah, you know. Or,
yeah.
or like shrinking down into the quantum verse or whatever in Ant-Man. You know, they come up with these sort of clever, so they don't be deus ex machina or whatever. They don't become like just pulled out of nowhere. They always have to show them to you earlier. As a writer, you know, and you know this too, it's a thing that we always bear in mind, which is it's, I always have said it's the reverse of is it Chekhov's gun, right? Because he said if you show a gun in Act 2, fire it in Act 4. And I've always said if you're planning to fire a gun in Act 4, you better show they have it in Act 2 so you don't just pull it out of nowhere, you know. I think the reverse of it is even more valuable. And it's just interesting to me how they, you know, you can almost spot them now. When they do the trick with the repulsors that causes the explosion during the party, you know, looking back now, you're like, well, I should have known, file that away because we'll see that again later.
Yeah, right.
You know?
But – Yeah, and they do it. They do it very well. They do it very well. And I don't know about you, but usually when I write, it's I get to the scene where I need the gun, and then I'm like, oh, all right. Where can I go back and put the gun to make sure it's there when I need it at the end?
I've done that.
But they're fighting a guy who has whips coming, you know, on his arm. So how big are the whips? 15 feet? 20 feet?
Yeah.
You are in a suit of armor that flies, fighting a guy that doesn't fly. Just go up so he can't hit you and drop things down on him. I mean, you know, how tough is that?
I mean,
the big plan should have been like we'll each, you know, grab a whip and then fire towards the middle and do that thing we did, you know, back in the earlier part of the movie. It should have been, I'll go 30 feet this way, you go 30 feet that way, and we'll take them out from a distance.
So. Yeah, they have distance weapons. They have range in RPGs. They call that ranged weapons, right? They have ranged weapons, and he does it. So I mean, yeah, it's a good point. It's a very practical point. I hadn't really thought about it. While we're talking about the battle at the end, also it's not something I thought of as apparent. It was apparent to me the first time. But after what we've been through with some movies since then, did you notice that when all the drones and the temporarily overtaken war machine are attacking and chasing Tony, instead of flying out over the ocean or something, he buzzes all the places where people are standing behind glass?
Yeah. There is an amazing disregard for public safety in this film.
It's amazing.
It is frightening. Especially like, okay, this big expo, right? This City of Tomorrow thing. There is an inordinate amount of glass there just waiting to be shattered.
It is.
You know? Like, I mean, I don't know if I've ever seen a set designed to be destroyed more than the expo that it uses. I mean, it's like, I don't know, not well designed. Yeah, I think, you know, but I think, you know, to go back to my point, you know, the snarky remark about just fly 30 feet away and shoot at him from a distance, that's the kind of thing you only notice, you know, that I only notice because the film is dissatisfactory. Like, that's not why I don't like the film, right? And I don't even say I dislike the film, but that's not why I don't like that sequence, is not because they could just fly 30 feet away and attack from a distance. It's because the scene itself is dissatisfactory. The resolution is dissatisfactory. You know, Vanko's big achievement is to just make his whips bigger, you know, more powerful. Like, it doesn't none of that works. And so because none of that works, my mind wanders and it wonders why people don't just fly 30 feet away. Like, it's not the common sense of the scene is not what ruins it, right? It's the fact that the emotional arcs don't pay off, that the fight sequence is kind of dull. That's what bothers me, right? The snark is just there to kick somebody when it's down, I suppose.
what did you think about my reaction to Black Widow being in it? I mean, did you like her more this time around or less, or how'd you react to her?
Yeah, I think Scarlett Johansson in this character is phenomenal. I think she's been great, and like every time she shows up, I think the way she's evolved, like, well, I won't say great every time. I do think the Banner romance in Avengers 2 was stupid. but I mean, I just think it's really stupid. I think really, like, it just offends me from like a narrative point of view. But I think, she's great here. I will say the film is I don't know. This time it really bothered me. Really bothered me the way the film treats women this time around. And like, you know, she's great. You know, she kick ass. She's competent. But there's always this focus on her looks, right?
Yeah.
The way Stark treats her at the beginning.
Yep.
And you know, and then she gets her revenge on Happy because Happy's kind of condescending to her. So that one pays off, mm-hmm. right? And she gets her comeuppance on Stark later on. But even like, when she orders Happy to drive her over to Hammer Industries, right? Mm. And she changes in the back seat, like, and he's focused on her. Like, we don't need that. Like,
yeah.
We just don't need it. I mean, I think that devalues the character. And Pepper is, I mean, she's been made CEO of this company. I mean, the whole idea is like, she's the hidden strength of this company. And yet, too much of it is just her being exasperated. right? There's not enough of her kind of, you know, she does at the end when she takes on Hammer directly. I mean, I do think it's interesting that, like, lesser Tony Stark gets defeated by Pepper there at the end, you know, but I mean, even that is, I mean, how does she defeat him? She calls the cops, you know?
Yeah.
The scene that really, really, really bothers me is when they're in Monaco and Hammer is getting interviewed by
The same girl from the first movie. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't remember her character's name, but
no, I don't either.
By the reporter. Right.
Yeah.
Getting interviewed by the reporter. And I mean, it's essentially the actress is Leslie Bibb, but I don't know what her, Everhart maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it.
And I mean, it's essentially about 30 seconds of like slut shaming, and it really like bothers me. Where it's like Pepper can't get over the fact that, you know, the reporter had sex with Tony, who's had sex with half the planet, right? I mean, it's just that's one of those things where you hear it, you don't see a lot of it, but you hear it like constantly in the film, right? In the two films that, you know, he's always running around.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you get this moment where she's interviewing Hammer, and there is no suggestion that there's anything sexual between Everhart and Hammer. In fact, she seems to be resisting all of his attempts to make it sexual.
Yes.
And yet then you have Tony and Pepper like completely like really being inappropriate. I mean, you know, Pepper says something about like, oh yeah, you did a spread for Tony last year, you know? And then like Tony like repeats like the word spread, like you did a good job on that spread or something. And it's just, I mean, it's just so like there are little moments that are really kind of like offensive to me about the film that the film just doesn't need, because they don't add anything to it in terms of its treatment of women. But Natasha as a character, right, is and Johansson's performance, yeah, it's the best performance in the film, I think.
Yeah, I think
as
so.
As much as I enjoy Downey's portrayal of Stark, I think Johansson's performance in this film is the best part of the film for me.
I do like how Rockwell kind of, because it's close to me between the two of them, I like how Rockwell, he has his character down so much that every time he walks into the room, he precedes himself by yelling. Like his shout comes into the scene before he walks in. Every time he comes into room, he's like, "Well, Baba," you know, and has some little setup of himself. It's so weird, but it works. I mean, he is such a weird, but he's a multi-level character in how he portrays him that way. I do the thing about Gwyneth Paltrow. I like, you know, you're talking about at the end when she goes up against Hammer, and I liked that he's doing his dissembling kind of slimy bit. And his patter, you know, and every time it cuts to her, she's just like a rock. She's just like a statue looking at him. And you know, the sense that I got is that she's almost like she's thinking, if I can deal with Tony Stark on a daily basis, you know, you throwing all this bluster at me is a joke. You know, she just looks at him like he's a bug.
Right.
He's like, I'm Justin Hammer. I've got $1 billion. She's just like looking at him like, I want to step on you, basically. and she just doesn't take any crap off of him at all. So I did appreciate that about her.
But like her victory moment, right? And I think this gets to your point about how good of a performance it is from Rockwell.
Mm-hmm.
Like Pepper's moment of ascendancy in the film does not come when Tony names her CEO.
Right.
It comes when Hammer says, like, you're learning to be a CEO. Right?
Yeah.
Like, you're learning to eliminate the competition. And this gets back to your idea that, like, the parts are better than the sum. Like, I love that moment, but I also, like, I am here to see Stark. He should be the center of the film, right? And I think too much of the center of the film gets away from him. And then in the second half, or in the latter third, let's say, he becomes like functional. Like he's just the guy running in the suit, running around shooting things, offering, you know, weak apologies. And so like the other characters like sort of elevate the film, and it's nothing about the performance. It's just kind of how the characters are written and how the story progresses that I end up liking and wishing I had seen more of the other characters and less of what they do with Tony. Maybe not less of Tony, but less of what they do with Tony in the middle. Like, I think, you know, they had to bring him down too far to build him back up to not a place where he was even at in the first film.
One other character I want to mention that I think deserves a little more attention is Gary Shandling as the senator.
Yeah.
Senator Stern, yeah. I think. Because, yep. I mean, as we find out later that he's a Hydra, was it in Captain America 2, maybe, that we find out he's a Hydra agent. And in some ways, I was almost disappointed by that, because he didn't have to have Evil Incorporated, ID card to be that. I just like the idea that he could just be a jackass politician that, you know, just resents Tony and favors Hammer and treats Tony as badly as he can and is trying to, because, I mean, politicians do stuff like that every day. You know, members of our Congress act like him every day. They don't have to be Hydra agents to do that. They can just be jerks.
My guess is he wasn't intended to be a Hydra agent when they filmed Iron Man 2.
Right, right,
but
I agree.
His performance was so good, they wanted to bring him back in a later film.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, well, we'll turn him into a Hydra agent, kind of after the fact.
I agree. I think you're right. I think that's exactly right. I don't think that was ever in their mind when they made this movie. He just was such a good, bad, crappy, scheming, conniving, sniveling politician. But Shandling, because I've never really watched his show or anything. I've seen some of his stand-up over the years. He passed away, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
I think he did.
Yeah, yep.
But, I mean, I just love how they really picked the right guy to play this character, because Gary Shandling always had that kind of, not sniveling, but he just, his persona that he projects is always a very uncomfortable, you know, personality. And so making him a U.S. senator who then still talks like that was just inspired, I thought.
Yeah, sort of like uncomfortable, aloof, like not like trying to throw his weight around, like trying to say something. And that's why, like, his best moments are, you know, when he loses his cool, right?
Yeah.
And he's just like, no, we're done. Get off. We're done. You know, like, he can see that it's like it's falling apart. And where Hammer is, like, he also sees that it's falling apart, but is trying to, like, salvage a victory. The career politician is like, no, you just take the loss and move on, right?
Yeah.
Like, there'll be a chance. And he has his moment of victory later on when he's on one of the news shows and saying, like, look, I was right. You know, ultimately I was right and he was wrong. But yeah, he is, it's a great performance. And, you know, but so many of the small performances are good too. Like, I love Favreau's Happy Hogan. Like, I mean, I think it's just a great character. I mean, you know, Clark Gregg's Phil Coulson. It's like, you remember why you fell in love with that character when he does this. There's one of these appearances, right? It's like, oh yeah, that guy was awesome. And so John Slattery as his dad, Howard Stark.
Yeah.
All these kind of work. It's just, I don't know why the film doesn't ultimately come together for me, but it feels, I mean, what's Tony's arc in this story, right? Like, I don't feel like it's very interesting or satisfactory that the guy who brought peace to the world, like one guy shows up on a racetrack and like, how did he know that? I mean, I guess he knew Stark was going to be in Monaco, but he didn't know Stark was going to jump in the car. Right.
Right.
So,
right.
So why did Vanko have a job as, like, one of the
racetrack?
I don't know. That's a nitpicking, I guess. But it just feels like the film didn't I don't know if it wasn't conceived well, wasn't executed well, if there were too many hands in the pot. But it feels like it definitely suffers from, like, sequelitis. And so all the little parts are better than the part as a whole. When I get to the end of the film, I mean, I'm not satisfied. You know, I'm not like, yeah, that was a good 2 hours of my time. It feels kind of like, all right, off to the next thing.
Well, it's kind of the same thing that the Avengers 2, Avengers Age of Ultron, suffered from in a much bigger way. I think Age of Ultron comes together a little better, but in both cases, it just seems like they're trying to juggle way too many balls at the same time just to have that particular ball in the air. And at some point, you start losing focus on what you're doing because there's just so many balls in the air. This was the first Marvel movie where I think that it felt like they were trying to build the universe.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, they definitely had, you know, the kind of, I mean, we had seen evidence of it before, but this was the first time it felt like, like the universe was playing an integral role in the film, right? That it wasn't just an Easter egg. It wasn't just an end credit scene, that they were trying to build something. I do wonder if, you know, cause you, you know, I just thought about it when you brought up, you know, Avengers 2 was also being, you know, slightly less than the original. What both of those films have in common is that it was the same director came back for the second time.
Yeah.
You know, so I wonder if there's some director fatigue there. I wonder if there's whether it's, you know, Joss Whedon has kind of openly talked about, you know, being dissatisfied with working, you know, in the Marvel system.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, you know, I don't remember Favreau saying anything like that. I mean, he certainly stayed more involved in the world as like a producer, you know, and had like a real role to play. But, you know, they just both of those films, you know, they feel more tired, I think, than they should. And they feel more, you know, victims of sequelitis. I mean, we just come back to that. Like it feels like, okay, we have to give you the things you liked in the first one, but we're going to try to make it more serious in this one, right? We're going to try to introduce some things that, you know, will make it feel more like a movie. Where, I mean, I think like Whedon's script for the first Avengers movie is as good as any script as you will ever find anywhere. Like, I mean, I think the way he juggles all those separate character arcs is phenomenal. I mean, I think it's mind blowing. Mm-hmm. You know, Iron Man 2 and even Avengers 2, they don't have that same, they don't feel like, it doesn't feel like a consistent vision to me.
Right.
And I think that's why those films suffer a little bit from the first ones.
Yeah, a story needs to be concise, and it doesn't need a lot of extraneous stuff that takes away from the story. Now, Marvel would argue, well, this stuff is important because it's building on later movies and all, but you don't want to, if it doesn't play into the current story, then it becomes, you know, superfluous or distracting. And I get that sense a lot in both of those movies.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't feel like James Rhodes is a real character in this film. I feel like he has a story to tell. I mean, in a lot of ways, he is the most interesting character in this film to me because he is the one who is put between a rock and a hard place by Tony more than anyone.
Yeah.
Right? And his decision to steal the War Machine armor, that should resonate bigger than it does.
Right? Absolutely.
Because that is a guy caught between like duty to his, you know, job, duty to his country, and, you know, duty to his friend. And it feels like it absolutely should be a bigger moment. Like, we should have got more build up to that. We should have seen more conflict so that moment resonated better. And yet it ultimately just ends up feeling like he's a sidekick, right? And that's like, I do like the scene where Hammer is showing him all the weapons, because this is at least like Rhodey giving you a sense of how he would do Iron Man differently. And it's the only time we really get a sense of that. Like I want all of these weapons. I don't like, and they're all practical weapons for the most part, right? They're all, they're guns, right? They're very militaristic. They're not ion cannons and laser cannons and, you know, electromagnetic pulses. I mean, they're all just kind of, you know, kind of meat and potatoes weapons.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right that, I mean, that, but Rhodey is all over the map in this movie, and you can kind of see the arc they're trying to put him through, but it's not very cohesive because, like you say, at one point he basically steals Iron Man's backup suit of armor and ultimately delivers it, whether he meant to or not, to Justin Hammer. And if I was Tony, I would be like, I'm never speaking to you again. I'm revoking all your access. Instead they just laugh it off and they're back to being best buddies after they team up to fight, what's his name at the very end? Black Whiplash. So Rourke. So there's a number of character inconsistencies that kind of spoil, spoil it for me, but I guess I'm going to conclude here. We've got a couple minutes left. I'll conclude with by saying this. I felt like the things that I it may be that I knew the bad stuff or remembered the bad stuff, the disappointing stuff, and so the stuff that was good, I was able to cling to more than the first time, because at the first time I watched it, I didn't know those were going to be the only good things, you know. So like I say, I really enjoyed the battle at the end. I liked Black Widow a lot. I liked they used a couple of different armors. And I enjoyed seeing Tony Stark being Tony Stark again. But yeah, the overall thing just doesn't hang together very well. What's your sort of final verdict?
Maybe it's the flip of yours. Maybe because I had a better experience seeing the film in the theater, I thought better of it then that now. Yeah, it's kind of the opposite. Maybe the negative things stand out a little bit more in this time. I mean, I look at this, you know, I always like to bring it back to the comics. And to me, like, if you got Iron Man 2 as like a 50-cent back issue, it does what you want, right? It's an Iron Man story. Mm-hmm. Some cool fights. There's some funny lines. Stark being Stark, right? Like, that would you'd be satisfied. But, like, now we've seen so many other things. We've had so many other movies that just – are just so much better made that, you know, I think Iron Man 2 really is, you know, and it ends up near the bottom, and it's to the credit of the Marvel Cinematic Universe that, you know, that the film does sit closer to the bottom than the top, because it's not a bad film at all. And it's never a bad thing to watch Robert Downey Jr. playing this version of Tony Stark. Like, I mean, that's always good. And, you know, Sam Jackson is good. Scarlett Johansson's good. All the performances are good. I think the script really let it down. And I think that sense of, you know, it's interesting. You said, you know, this is the one, you know, where they're trying to build the, you know, the Marvel world more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought the Hulk, the Incredible Hulk movie and the Iron Man movie that preceded this, those worlds felt like real worlds to me. This one feels too much like a mix, right? It's like, yeah. This one feels like you've got your tried and true recipe for, you know, soup, and you're making it on the stove, and you decide at the last second, well, let's throw this ingredient in and see what happens. Let's throw this in and see what happens.
Yep.
And it ends up being okay, but also kind of disappointing at the same time.
Yeah, too many things distracting and all that. Yeah. Well, I guess at some point we're going to have to talk about the Incredible Hulk. What's the next, remind me, what comes up next, sequentially after this one, Cap or Thor?
Thor comes up.
Good. Okay.
After this. So it's Thor, then the first Captain America, and then the Avengers movie.
Excellent. We got stuff to look forward to. I love the first Thor movie, so I'm going to really enjoy that. So, all right. Well, we're going to wrap things up here. I think we've dug through Iron Man 2 about as much as it really needs digging through. So, Mark, thanks for joining me again here on the Avengers Assemble podcast, and we're going to hook up with you again the next time it's time to dig into a movie.
Great. Thanks for having me.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.